Oh, I love being on this show sometimes just because I get to hear stuff like that. They've been prolific, releasing 7 full-length albums in the last 12 years and 5 EPs and guesting on a lot of recordings for other artists. Their new album is called Bloom. Their U.S. tour runs April 8th to June 1st. That was Larkin Poe. Thank you to Larkin Poe and their band. Thanks to Victoria Canal. Our thanks to Christian Lopez. Thank you to Ray Zaragoza and to Ron Pope. Thank you to everyone here in Morgantown on the campus of West Virginia University. And thanks to you out there listening on the radio. Because without you, there'd be no Mountain Stage. We never forget that. I hope you'll be back next week as we welcome the MC Taylor Goldsmith Show, Johnny Fritz, Cat Edmondson, Scott Mulvihill, and Ken Pomeroy. Mountain Stage is produced by Larry Gross and Adam Harris. Senior producer is Jeff Shirley. Associate producers are John Ingram and Mallory Richards. We're engineered by Patrick Stevens, Richie Collins, Scott Robinson, and Greg McGowan, with production assistance by Michael Lipton, Lance Schrader, Chris Mead, Don London, Kelly Lassiter, Jen Brown, Sam Porter, Jay Lipschutz, and Tony Patterson. Photographic services by Chris Morris. Promotion is coordinated by Mallory Richards, John Ingram, and Music in Motion Promotions. Special thanks to Mountain Stage members Walter and Sean Williams for their generous support. Lodging is provided by the Marriott Town Center Hotel, centrally located for the business and pleasure traveler in downtown Charleston, West Virginia. Mountain Stage was founded by Andy Ridenour, Francis Fisher, and Larry Gross. Why don't you go out and hear some live music wherever you are?
Major funding for Mountain Stage is provided by Bailey Glasser.
We are listener-supported non-commercial radio from the campus of Henry Ford College. This is WHFR Dearborn.
We're going to do this old, beautiful Carla Bonoff song for you tonight. Here we go.
Traveling at night, the headlights were bright.
It's Radiothon 2025. Hi, I'm Pat Frisco, Program Director at WHFR. And as WHFR broadcasts into our 40th year, we ask for your pledges of support to your radio station. Call us now at 313-845-9676, option 1, or pledge online at WHFR.fm.
The following program has been pre-recorded. The views expressed by the participants are not necessarily those of WHFR Radio or Henry Ford College. Welcome to We Are Not Alone. We're local investigators, as well as world-renowned scientists and ufologists, share their latest evidence in support of the UAP reality. I'm David Twitchell, and for the next hour, we'll be exploring the mysteries of the UFO, UAP, and abduction phenomenon.
Earl Grey Anderson is MUFON's State Director of Southern California, a STAR team member, and an executive member of MUFON's Experiencer Resource Team. Earl has hosted MUFON's Experiencer workshops at the last 3 MUFON symposia. Earl has personally investigated over 1,000 UFO reports and specializes in experiencer slash high strangeness cases. Earl has shared the stage with Travis Walton, Jennifer Stein, Seth Tok, and Cheryl and Linda Costa. Earl teaches an accredited course in ufology, called the UFOs and Other Worlds, at Los Angeles Otis College of Art and Design. Earl Gray Anderson is currently writing his first book, The Gray Files, which will be published in this year, 2025. He dotes on his 3 children and 3 grandchildren and lives happily in Los Angeles with his wife, Lisa, and his cat, Thor. He has appeared on multiple radio shows, podcasts, and TV shows, such as Ancient Aliens, Steve Bassett's Paradigm Shift, the Travel Channel's Storming Area 51 special, the season finale of Motor Trend Television's Motor Mythbusters, Cars vs. UFOs, and will be the featured host on the new TV series, The Alien Disclosure Files. So, I'm proud to have him included, and we are not alone, and added to that list. So, welcome, Earl Gray Anderson.
Thank you, David. You read the long sheet there. You even got my cat Thor in there, but he's banished to the other room. He'll sometimes come in and interrupt. You know, he'll not be getting enough attention, and right. We'll have the cat climbing on the keyboard effect. You know,
cats and dogs.
Yeah.
So I usually begin my interviews by asking my guests what got you started on the UFO quest?
Oh goodness! Well, we're going right to the finish line here, cut the chase, as they say.
Right.
I'm one of the rare people, I guess, although I'm finding out I'm not as rare as I thought, who grew up with disclosure. My mom worked during the Cold War in a deep underground military facility when she was working as Howard Hughes's personal secretary.
Wow.
Now, people knew that my mom worked for Hughes. That was no secret. That was, she liked to brag about it, in fact. When I was 5 years old, I should give a little preamble to that. I had this very strange sort of a ritual that I did when I was a little kid. Every day I would go and climb up the monkey bars in our backyard. We had a nice wooden swing set. My dad liked to do carpentry stuff. And I'd get up to the top of the monkey bars and I would wave and I would sing at the sky. And I'll never forget this. My mom opened up the kitchen window. We lived in Venice, California, Lake Street. It's about less than a mile from the beach there. But she opened the kitchen window and she just shouted at me, "Who are you waving and singing to?" You know, she thought maybe the birds or she didn't know. And I told her, "I'm waving and singing to the space people, Mom, the space people."
I see. How old were you?
And I was about 4 years old, and apparently I'd been doing it for a while, and she just it got her curiosity going. I think, you know, maybe a year went past, and I sort of carried on with this little behavioral quirk. And there was one morning that my mom sat across from my cornflakes. And it was a school day. I was going to kindergarten. This is how young I was, 5, you know, but thankfully I have, I don't know, maybe to my detriment, a very good memory. But she sat across from me and she started talking to me like I was a grown-up, which got my attention. Looking back on it, I think that what my mom knew weighed on her shoulders. And she did, I found out later that, of course, she signed many NDEs, non-disclosure or NDAs, non-disclosure agreements. Mm-hmm. So she wasn't supposed to tell me what she told me, which became a little problem a few years later. But anyway, my mom sat across from me and she told me about, she said, well, son, you know that I worked for Howard Hughes, but there's something about my job that people don't know about. And she just started telling this narrative story about how they took her out to the middle of the desert. She said the Great American Desert. Doing some research, I think it may have been, probably was Nevada, but it could have been White Sands. But she said that there was nothing out there except this little shack. And it was herself and a small security detail of two guys that accompanied her. Hmm. She didn't know why they had taken her out to the middle of nowhere to look at. She wondered if it was a tractor, or she couldn't imagine what they were going to show her in this shack. It was like a bunker, but she called it a shack. And I've heard other people refer to this same type of facility as a shack. So that may be the official term that they use. Okay. But they unlocked this thing, and there was only one thing in there, and that was an elevator. And my mom said that she got into this elevator and she thought maybe it would go a floor or two down, but it kept going. And it was going very at quite a clip to where she said that she felt butterflies in her stomach. That was how she described it. Mm-hmm. She said that when it came to a stop, the doors opened up and she said that there was a little city that was under the desert. They did not tell her what to expect. She said that that there were a lot of, you know, German rocket scientists that she was working with, that there were a lot of scientists in general that worked in there working on top secret projects.
Von Braun?
She mentioned Von Braun, Werner Von Braun. She actually at one point in a different circumstance, we were watching The Wonderful World of Disney. In black and white. I think it was called The Wonderful World of Color, but we had a black and white TV set.
Right.
And Werner von Braun comes on and he's explaining the staged rocketry, you know, the Saturn V, which was his baby. And my mom says, that was my friend Werner. I worked with Werner and he's a charming man. He used to call me Betty Grace, which was my mom's first and middle name. By the way, there's a picture of my mom from around that time period. That was her around, I don't know, 55 or so.
It's a shame that my radio audience can't see that.
Oh, whoops. I didn't know if we were visual or just audio. No, I'll keep away from showing further pictures. But if you had imagined, kind of, you know, she was a pretty brunette young housewife at that point. Mm-hmm. And she, anyway, my mom said that, you know, they had cafes down there. They had a barber shop, but the barber could do her hair for her.
Oh, goodness. Under the
yeah. And after I thought, you know, I got a little older and some of the stuff she said, it, you know, I thought about it. It's like, well, you don't go down to this complex one time for a day and have your hair done. So she must have spent some time down there. Oh. Later on, I found out that she worked there while she was pregnant with me. But she talked about working down there on top secret projects that they got around in golf carts. And I've met other people whose parents had similar stories. You know, I've talked about this a few times on air, but probably more than a few times. And every once in a while, somebody will get a hold of me and say, hey, my dad had a similar story. I know Dan Harari, who runs the Hollywood Disclosure Alliance, his father had a similar story where they took him to this facility that was underground. They showed him something that changed his life entirely. Mm-hmm. Somebody else told me recently, my mom called it the city. Whenever she would reference where she worked, she used the term the city. And recently I spoke with a woman whose father worked in either the same facility or a different facility that was similar. And that she said that her father called it the city too. And the reason why is because the different tunnels were named after different streets in New York. And you'd be given an address. So you'd go to the tunnel that was the, you know, Broadway or 52nd Street or whatever it would be. And then you would have an address, which would be one of the particular doors. And you'd go to that door and they would open it. It would be secured still, even while you're underground. And one, her father had to climb this tall, kind of a steep staircase, opened up this door, and she said that whatever he saw, and he wouldn't say what it was, he said that the other aerospace engineer that was with him fainted. He kept his composure, and I wonder what was they showed him, maybe a craft hovering over the ground, or beings, or both. I don't know.
Probably the beings.
But anyway, this, my mom, when I was five, she wrapped up the conversation just by saying, "Son, I just want you to know that you go out there and you wave and sing to the space people. And I want you to know that there are space people, that we already know we aren't alone. And you're going to hear about UFOs and all this stuff, flying saucers. I just want you to know that that's not, that really is a real thing. So when you go out and you wave and sing to the space people, there are space people. Now it's time to go to school." And she had my bag lunch ready for me, and off I went, play in the sandbox or something. But this never left me, this story. And over the years, I would try to get her to talk about it more. And she wouldn't. Usually she wouldn't. Sometimes stuff like the Wernher von Braun story would come up. Unbidden, you know, like it would just pop out of her mouth. And I saw my mom occasionally talk too much, and you could tell that she felt guilty, like she wasn't supposed to. In fourth grade, I went and I gave a little lecture to my fourth grade class, to a bunch of 10-year-olds and my teacher, about my mom's old job.
Show and tell, huh?
Yes, exactly. Friday show and tell. And my teacher, she scheduled a conference with my mom to find out where this wild story came from. And she was also concerned because the kids were calling me Spacey Earl and doing, you know, antennae behind my head, like my favorite Martian. And there was a tease factor involved, ridicule factor even back then, you know. We know about that in ufology. But anyhow, my mom came out of this meeting with a teacher. I was playing on the monkey bars in the recess area, probably waving and singing to the space people again. And she was very stern, which my mom usually didn't have that kind of countenance, but she was very stern and quiet. And we walked to the car, and I got a lecture, a very upset and disturbed lecture from my mom. She said, "Earl, you didn't lie to your teacher or your class. What I told you was true, but I had to tell your teacher that you have a very good imagination." She was apologetic about that. She got into the driver's seat and she looked at me, and I'll never forget this, David. She looked at me and she said, "My God, how did you remember that? You were just a baby." And she's trying to drive home from this teacher's parent-teacher conference. But she said, "Son," she said, "I wasn't supposed to tell you what I told you. People don't know about little cities under the desert, and they certainly don't know about intelligent life in outer space. So I had to tell your teacher that you were making something up, but you weren't, and I know it." And she said, "You can never talk about this again. I could get in trouble." She's driving a bit more, and then she looks at me again, looks over to my, you know, the passenger seat, and she says, "I could go to prison if you ever talk about this."
Wow.
So I didn't. I had that cut off the, you know, the conversation. I never really told people about it again. But, you know, around 1977, I took my mom to see Star Wars. She had gone to her oncologist that day for a checkup because she'd had cancers. I found out a lot of people that worked in these deep underground military bases, they did have cancers. I don't know if it's because they were powering them off a nuclear pile and didn't know how to protect people, or downwind from Trinity site, although, I mean, they were underground. So, but anyway, she had a clear cancer screening, and I think she was in a good mood. She was in the Santa Monica area where she, I mean, she Howard Hughes aircraft building was just a hop over there from Santa Monica, is El Segundo. Mm-hmm. Whatever, the stars aligned for me, and my mom started talking again. And she said that, son, you have no idea how close to the truth Star Wars is. It's not a far-fetched movie. She said the different beings, the different spacecraft, it's really like that out there. Mm. But they'll never tell the public. And she doubled down on that. She said they will never, ever in a million years tell the public.
Mm. We can't.
Now, by this time, I was older.
Yeah, the book, we can't tell the people.
I haven't read that, but that is a ongoing meme that I think the military industrials hold dearly too, like a life preserver. you still see the obfuscation and trying to silence the whistleblowers and all that, you know, is still going on. I sometimes wonder if my mom had lived, if she would have been one of these whistleblowers, but I'll never know that. The temperature out there while she was alive, she passed in 1999, was still obfuscate and tamp down and don't let any of this out to the public. It's only been some.
If the whistleblowers of today are being still ridiculed and scoffed at by whomever, that would have definitely been that way back then in 99, don't you think?
Yes.
Yeah.
I mean, I know people that, you know, were badgered and maybe worse for going public with things. Mark McCandless is one name that, you know, comes to mind. Mm-hmm. Supposedly committed suicide. And I spoke to him a week before that happened. And he was happy as a clam. He was recently retired. He was an aerospace illustrator. He illustrated for Aerospace Weekly and things like that. But he's the guy that he talked about the ARV, which apparently is the alien reproduction vehicle. And not only did he talk about it, but he drew a blueprint for it, kind of a working blueprint for a anti-gravity lifting platform.
I think I've seen it. Yeah.
Yeah. You guys don't have visual out there, but I actually have the blueprint painting over my library here. I was told that he went a bridge too far when he did that blueprint, that he was told that, you know, he needed to be very circumspect. Mm-hmm. And I think he got into trouble. And I'm careful about, you know, I'll have cases come in sometimes where I think it's a national security issue. And I won't talk about those cases in public. If I think that it was something that was ours, is military, I'm careful about that.
Right.
I'm, you know, I love my country. I am a patriotic man. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm not one of these guys that has a flag on their truck or something. But my mom was a patriot. I mean, on her deathbed, we talked some more.
Yeah.
And again, she said they'll never tell the public. She brought up H.G. Wells' War of the Worlds broadcast, how people reacted badly to it. And recently I've seen a CIA document that John Greenwald published on the Black Vault. Mm-hmm. And that was the main reason that the CIA gave for not telling the public in this document, that they brought up the War of the Worlds radio broadcast.
Right.
So my mom was quoting. Yeah,
so I have something. To take a brief break right now just to remind my listeners that you're listening to WHFR.FM, the station making waves. And I'm David Twitchell, your host for We Are Not Alone. We're speaking with researcher and author, Mr. Earl Gray Anderson. So you were saying before, now I didn't want to interrupt, but... Go ahead, your mom. What?
Well, on her deathbed, I'd read an article where some people that had worked at Area 51, and this was where we were told that there was such a thing as Area 51, by the way, that had been disclosed because some workers had been poisoned by the burn pits they had there. And they had health consequences due to that. And they successfully sued the federal government, Area 51, for exposing them to these materials. And I told my mom that I thought she should lawyer up. My mom was dying of cancer again. You know, she'd gotten cancer five times at this point. She kept working in aerospace, by the way. She tried to be a housewife in the early 60s, and she was miserable. She hated it. And she went back working as a headhunter, a corporate headhunter for aerospace companies. And her contracts, they read like David Grush's list of gatekeepers of this, you know, anomalous vehicles and biologicals and all that. It was, you know, Northrop, Lockheed Skunk Works, TRW, which was Ramo Woolrid back in the 60s when my mom worked. That they used to be connected with Hughes Aircraft. And she was getting people from floor sweepers all the way up to nuclear engineers at these facilities. And she was very proud. She said that she had kept her security clearances. And I believe my mom was probably an operative most of her life. I think that she was recruited. She was deputized, believe it or not, a woman was deputized back in the 1940s. Wow. More or less, she lived in Iowa, a small town called Muscatine, and they needed somebody to watch the drunk tank on the weekends.
Watch
the drunk tank at the jail.
Oh, I see. Okay.
And my mom got that auspicious title of drunk tank supervisor, but they had to deputize her. So she was a deputy sheriff and a woman. And I think that maybe this is why she was recruited for what she wound up doing. But very proud of her security clearances, and she doubled down about the non-disclosure thing. She said they'll never do it. She brought up, again, how people reacted to the War of the Worlds. She brought up that it could harm world religions and the banking system. And she just said, it'll never happen, son, but it's realer than you'll ever know. And that bothered me because I want to know. You know, I think we have a right to know. I told her in so many words, you know, it's one of those questions, you know, is there a God? What happens when I die? And are we alone in the universe? And she had one of the answers.
And who killed Kennedy, right?
Yeah, that's another one. But anyway, my mom passed in 1999. And I never did get the golden ticket. You know, she never did say, well, there are these little gray aliens and there are these tall blonde ones and, you know, some that look like praying mantises. She never, you know, she wouldn't tell me any of that stuff. Well, only that it was real.
Pretty much, according to you, she pretty much did tell you about that, in that she said Star Wars is pretty much.
Yeah. Star Wars is not far-fetched. Those were her exact words, quote unquote. Mm-hmm. So, this is how I wound up joining MUFON, and I took to it like a fish to water because I just had this burning desire. I'd lived with this information all of my life, and I was getting older. I was in my early 50s, and I'd been reading some literature out there. I read the Leslie Kane's book about pilots and generals, and I thought it was informative. It backed up what my mom had told me at such a tender age, but it still didn't answer any questions for me. And I'll tell you the truth. I was still kind of skeptical about the whole UFO business because, you know, Carl Sagan said it was nonsense. Arthur C. Clarke said that UFOs were, you know, foolish, and Asimov and all those guys, you know, I kind of grew up reading those science fiction authors, and Carl Sagan was a hero.
Well,
Carl
Sagan began saying, UFOs are real.
Yeah, he did.
Not alone in the universe. And then somebody allegedly told him to shut up, and he changed his tune.
Stanton Friedman had the paperwork around that. Apparently he was told that it would be unfortunate if such a brilliant young astronomer as yourself wound up, you know, behind a desk, you know, with a clerk job. And apparently they offered him JPL, you know, in return for, you know, poo-pooing the whole UFO extraterrestrial contact thing. And another, you know, Arthur C. Clarke, that really confused me. I read every word that that man ever published from 2001, you know, Childhood's End, Rendezvous with Rama, all those great books, which you guys should read, you know, if you like to read good science fiction. Now, I'm very close friends with Paul and Joel Hynek. Paul especially is a good, you know, hangout friend of mine, and he has his father's correspondence with Arthur C. Clarke. And there's one letter where he talks to Dr. J. Allen Hynek and said, I believe that there is something to UFOs, that your scientific study into this issue is valid, but I can't ever say this in public because I'll never be invited to another moon launch ever again if I do. And that letter exists. You know, Paul can show that to you. I have a photo of it.
Oh, so there's all kinds of letters from
people
like that that say, oh, yeah, I know. I know it's a real thing, but I can't talk about it.
No, couldn't talk about it.
You know, so you mentioned earlier that a gentleman who allegedly committed suicide, is you know, and he was happy as a lark a couple of weeks before. There's a lot of people that have allegedly committed suicide.
Ooh, James Forrestal. James Forrestal, who's supposedly a member of the MJ-12, supposedly hung himself and jumped out of an asylum window. My friend Peter Robbins has a good video that you can get that talks about that history.
Yeah, your friend Peter Robbins.
Yeah, good old Peter. Yeah. Let me put it this way anyway, to kind of wrap up the whole MUFON thing. I'd heard about MUFON. I'd been watching the show Hanger One, and I thought that this is a cut above most of the UFO shows. A lot of these shows are, you know, sometimes the witnesses are unverified. It's kind of silly. These guys did this right, and they're real case files. Mm-hmm. And that decided for me to, you know, look up MUFON, see about becoming a field investigator and putting my hand to this myself. That's the only way I decided that I would ever be able to answer my questions and not have to trust somebody else's opinion on it. And I like it. Case number 1050, I think, now. Out of all those cases I have personally investigated, and oftentimes going, you know, feet on the ground to a site of an incident, speaking with full families, I pretty darn thorough. About a good 110 of those cases are bona fide UFO incidences of either alien contact, a UFO sighting, or you know, a UFO and contact incident.
So have you ever
pretty had good own, average?
Have you ever had your own personal anomalous experience?
Okay. Let's see how long is your show? We I don't know how.
Give us a reading.
In a nutshell,
digest version.
Well, I learned something interesting, and I still tell my field investigators this when I have a new field investigator. I just had a guy pass the field investigator test 2 days ago, and I'll be reiterating this for him as well, I'm sure, that when you poke at this phenomenon, it's interactive and it does poke back. That's something that I found out, that it seemed like the deeper that I went into this, and when I started talking with these, especially military witnesses, police officers, and hearing indisputable accounts, strange things began happening in my own life. Mm. I actually told my story on Ancient Aliens about 3 years ago now is when I did, and I had to talk with my wife about it because it involved her as well. And I knew that conversations around the Thanksgiving, you know, family dinner table would be a little different, you know, if I went forward with this. But I decided it was important to let people know that this is a very real and active phenomenon. It's not something that you can, it's not like you look through a telescope and it's some distant thing, or you're looking for radio signals from some distant world. It kind of becomes personal, not kind of, it becomes personal.
What about the personal experience that you've had?
Well, about 10 years ago, my wife and I had an experience. We were living in Burbank. I'd been working on case reports, of course, you know, like usual. Mm-hmm. And I just closed a case that was a Mylar balloon a guy saw. He thought it was a UFO, you know. And I was kind of feeling my oats. I was getting, so I knew my UFOs from my Mylar balloon, so to speak. Went upstairs and we had a contact experience. My wife was out, like somebody had drugged her, but our room began flooding with this bluish light. And you hear this repeated by so many people. It's almost like, it's like set and setting, and this is sort of how the Oz effect begins. Mm-hmm. Terry Randall came up with the phrase the Oz effect for the way that even the atmosphere around you changes when you have a contact experience. Mm-hmm. And it seemed like the air itself was aglow, and I'm lying there in bed. I'm looking at this. I was kind of semi-recumbent with a bunch of pillows behind my back. And I realized I can't move. So it wasn't sleep paralysis. I wasn't asleep yet. I was awake, you know, observing this weird phenomena in our room. And suddenly I couldn't move. And beings came into our room. I think that it was a transdimensional, maybe a portal or something that they opened up.
Right.
You could see this thing open up in front of the bed. Mm-hmm. And light poured out of this. It was like a hole in space. And the beings came through that. And they took blood. They did not communicate with me. I was scared. I was upset. You know, I wanted to meet ETs. Mm-hmm. But I, you know, was hoping to get like the nice tour of the, you know, Milky Way or something. And no, these guys were all business. They left like they came. They kept staring at me with those black eyes, and you can't look away from those eyes. Mm. It's like infinity when you look in them, and they have a hypnotic quality. Mm. Time became strange when this was happening. Like I couldn't tell if it was 5 minutes or an hour. Sounds were muffled. You could hear, I mean, we lived in Burbank. This wasn't in a rural area. You know, there was no room to park a spaceship outside of our house either. Right. Yes. So it had to have been like a Einstein-Rosen bridge or something that they opened up, that they mm-hmm. came through. And I was confused by this. Now, my wife didn't believe me. And then two nights later, though, she had the same thing happen. And she's the one that's shaking me and waking me up. And she was pacing next to the bed saying, "My God, Earl, you need to tell your little friend to leave us the alone." And I won't use the language. I didn't sign up for this. You know? Right. And that's so proverbial. My wife, I love her so much, but that's, she was not having it. Mm-hmm. And then two nights after that, and weirdly, we didn't talk about this the next morning. Okay. Right. Either time, like we'd come to some agreement not to talk about it. Mm-hmm. Third night, we both got up. The room again had that blue glow going on with no source for it. And but there was light coming out of the Venetian blinds in our bedroom. It was 3 a.m. and it looked like high noon outside. There was some kind of object over our house that was shining the beam down our backyard. And it was like a laser cannon. It was so bright. To where every leaf, you know, you could see the shadow and base relief underneath it, like you'd cut it out from black construction paper or something. It was that distinct. no diffusion of the light on the edges of objects. You'd see just like somebody had cut the leaf out and placed its dark, its shadow on the ground.
Mm-hmm.
Very distinct. And we're looking at this, and the idea, you know, being a field investigator, I'm trying to look for rational explanations. And the idea came into my head, maybe, is it a neighbor's porch light? It's like, no, you know, there's no, it would have to be like, the biggest, no, it was not a porch light. And my wife and I heard in our head, and this was the only communication I got from these guys,
mm-hmm.
heard in our heads at the exact same moment. And it was inside of our skull, but it was broadcast like a loudspeaker. Don't worry, it's just the neighbor's porch light. And Leeson and I were looking at each other, and this was so absurd and so funny to us that we were standing there laughing our butts off. And we said out loud, that is no blankety blank porch light. This is how the phenomena first manifested to me in a very real way.
It would seem that they, whoever they are, were able to read your minds and
yes.
say it's a porch
it
light.
Gave me an excuse.
And so they just fed that back to you. Sure.
Yeah, they did.
It's a porch light. Go back to sleep. Yeah.
But they fed it to Lisa too, which I find kind of funny.
Yeah.
We were laughing. I mean, we took it as a cosmic joke. It was hilarious. Now, Lisa didn't remember this occurrence. All she remembered was our room flooding with this blue light. And at least she remembered that. And I was able to, you know, talk with her. Well, sweetie, you know that light needs a source. And what flooded our room with the blue light? And she knew that. But recently, the memory of the third night has been coming back to her. A friend of mine, Steve Neal, he has a YouTube channel called Breaking the Silence. And Steve is a very talented CGI artist, worked on Star Trek and multiple films. And he's been doing experiencer stories with a CGI accompaniment, reenacted by, a CGI animation, very lifelike.
Mm-hmm.
And he did my wife and my experience from it's almost 11 years ago now when this happened. And we were watching this on our television, and suddenly my wife is grabbing onto my shirt and going, oh my God, this happened. This really happened. How could I forget? Mm-hmm. It jarred that memory for her.
Right.
And we find a lot of people, some people will go to a hypnotic a hypnotherapist to try to dislodge their memories.
Right.
I never did. I remembered mine for some reason, like I remember when I was a little kid. I don't know if they tried to make me forget, it didn't work, but it did work on my wife until she saw this film. You can see it on YouTube still.
What is the film? What is the name of the film?
It's called Breaking the Silence.
Okay.
Is Steve and his wife Mary's wonderful YouTube channel, and they do live streams, and they're close associates with Whitley Strieber, and Steve was also Dr. Roger Lear's close friend, so he was on a lot of the implant removal surgeries, things like that. Steve does camera work as well as his animation work, and he does hard special effects like mask work, and he's done all kinds of movie monsters and stuff like that. For films like Ghostbusters, the original Ghostbusters,
yeah.
That was his work. He did Arachnophobia. That scary thing was his special effects. All those spiders.
I saw it, but I hated it.
Yeah, me too. But Steve did the scary spiders.
So I need to take one more break to remind my listeners that you're listening to WHFR.FM, Making Waves. I'm David Twitchell, host of We Are Not Alone, and we're speaking with Earl Gray Anderson. He's a researcher, a MUFON member, and author. Oh, yeah, well, you're supposed to come out with your first book, The Gray Files. Has that come out yet this year?
Hasn't come out yet. What I'm doing, I've been writing, I was okayed by MUFON. If I talk about a case in public, I always redact names and anything that, you know, by which a witness could be identified, because we know that ridicule is a thing out there. We want to keep people safe and anonymous if that's their desire. Mm-hmm. But I was okayed to start sharing my very best case files in a British publication called Outer Limits Magazine. Mm-hmm. Really, you know, a very good magazine. And I've been doing this for about 6 years now. So my book is going to be mostly the articles or the case files that I've shared in Outer Limits Magazine. And then every other chapter is going to be personal anecdotes. So I'm sure that I'll be talking about what I just told you, because this phenomena is personal. It's not just some distant thing, or it's not like looking at microbes on a microscope slide. You know, it reaches back at you, and it does change you. People, and you know, my story, I'll tell you the truth. If somebody had told me 11 years ago what I just told you, what my wife and I experienced, I probably wouldn't have believed them. Oh. I was pretty darn skeptical about people that had contact stories. Mm-hmm. But when it happens to you, you have that experience, and you can't let that go away.
Right.
It is as real to me as waking up this morning and is this very moment is right now.
Right.
And it changes your life. It's a catalyst in a person's life when it happens. Mm-hmm. So is a UFO sighting, you know. Yeah. And I've had one UFO sighting, and it was a close up daytime sighting. I believe that I was targeted. I think that it was probably the same guys that I had the contact episode with back when.
Probably.
Was it a checkup or something? I don't know. I don't think that they took me, but they waited over the schoolyard, and it was a V-shaped craft. Wasn't a pretty UFO. It was this boxy looking thing, but it was massive tonnage, defying all the laws of that Newton set out, you know?
Right.
And there's a good reason for that. You know, it's the quantum universe. Oh. That was about 4.5, 5 years ago. And I was on my way to work. I worked as a hands-on nurse for 40 years. I retired about 4 years ago. And it was 6:30 in the morning, and this thing waited for me. And when I first saw it, again, I was skeptical. I'm going, how did the students fake this UFO? You know, well, there was nothing to hang it up from. I knew that this, all I knew is this was massive tonnage that was hanging in the air with no way to suspend it there. Closer I got to it, the weirder it got. Again, time seemed strange. Remember, I was driving a car. And I'm experiencing the Oz effect again. You couldn't hear external sounds outside of my car. Right. And there's this thing waiting for me. And when I first saw it, I was reacting like a ufologist. You know, I'm going to take photos, video, call MUFON, get a hold of the press, get other eyes on this. Mm-hmm. And the closer I got to it, I wasn't in control of my own thoughts. I thought they were my thoughts, but I started thinking things like, oh, it's an ugly UFO. There's no lights on it. You know, and I'm going to be late for work. And I drove right past Miracle like I was supposed to. But I was 35 feet away from it, closest approach.
Yeah.
And I saw it. I guess it was leaving. You know, I did like a shoulder check when I was directly across from it on the road. Mm-hmm. And it looked simultaneously like it was closer than it had been and like it was miles away. And talking to a physicist friend, he would say, well, that sounds like a lensing effect. I think that you were watching that object leave at possibly hyperspatial technology was being used there. Yeah. Quantum metricing. Yeah. I was be 3 miles away from that, and it was like I came to my senses, pull my car over. Of course, the object is no longer there. I'm face palming, going, thinking I'm worst UFO investigator in the world. I was embarrassed. I didn't even put a report into MUFON because I didn't want to admit that I had reacted so badly to a sighting. But that's, you can train for this, but when it happens, your training goes out the window.
And you didn't think to take your phone out and take a picture?
Nope.
That's it. That's it. You are not in control. They are in.
No, you're not.
And something like that happens.
Yep.
So you can't really blame yourself. So okay. So when is this book coming out? Tell me.
You know, I'm going to try to get it out. I'm hoping to have it out by July. That's when the next MUFON symposium is going to be, and I will be there. I'm you know, hosting an event, a Friday event at the symposium, and a Sunday event at a symposium, the best of the ERT we're doing again. It was very popular last year. Mm-hmm. And I'll be hosting the experiencer workshops. I may find a guest person to be the main host for those, but I'm always on that panel when we do the workshops. Mm-hmm. So I'm hoping to have the book out by then, and we'll see if, you know, publishing stuff will work out for that. I need to set aside like a month and finish it. That's the big the gorilla in the room, so to speak. But I'm going to do that, especially because my wife is bugging me. She says, you need to write your book, Earl. You need to have your book out.
You know what they say about writing? The hardest part of writing is putting your butt in the chair.
Exactly. Yeah. Or I'll get my butt in the chair and I have, you know, a lot of news people will get a hold of me, and you know, I just have to turn the phone off and just apply myself, and it will probably take a month and it'll be ready. So
right, well, now that we've had a nice conversation, we're almost done, but before I want to ask you, before we get to the end of this, if you'll come back on a later date and finish all these stories that I know you've got a bunch of them.
Sure, I'd love to. I'd be honored.
I'll keep in touch with us. So tell us about the STAR Team. What is the STAR Team?
STAR Team is MUFON's quick response group and you know, we use a lot of crime scene techniques where you create, you know, your space, and you have, you know, you put up the tape like you would for a crime scene. You don't want people to be walking on that area if it's been a landing site or it just takes a lot of training. And it goes beyond the regular field investigator training that we get. Use of a Geiger counter, use of an EMF monitor, a tri-field monitor, all that good stuff. You have to be adept at that. And in the years I've been with MUFON, I've been out, I think, on two what I would consider STAR Team cases. Mm-hmm. One was the site of a UFO landing, or it was a fireball crash. That's a long story because it affected this entire family, whose father was part of Project Blue Book, by the way. And wound up being a mucky muck at Burroughs Computer Corporation. But we don't have time to go into that. But another STAR Team case was a case that happened out in the San Bernardino area. It involved three different witnesses, two that were together and one that was 4 miles away, that saw the same thing that they saw, a UFO. Except he was in a different location and didn't know the other two people at all. He was actually a former Air Force pilot. And this involved a UFO hovering directly over a tree in a house. I did go around and there was a federally owned area there that used to be a torpedo testing reservoir. But it's the federal government bought this property, and they have the signs that warn you, and it's like Area 51 at this place. And I obeyed all the signage and stuff, but I still got an escort out of town by two military Humvees, which was very interesting. And that will probably open up my book, but that was a Star Team case. And we don't get a lot of landing cases or, you know, physical evidence cases where you go out and you take samples of the ground and stuff. But I know how to do that.
Yeah. I love books that are not just, you know, I saw a light in the sky, you know,
that there won't be any of that in my book.
Yeah. We get to the meat of it. Yeah. And tell us about your course, UFOs and Other Worlds.
I teach it with Heather Joseph Witham, who is, she has her doctorate in folklore, but the beauty of this is that she knows that the UFO phenomenon is real. She came to MUFON a few years ago and asked if they had an expert, I think was the word she used, in UFOs that would be willing to teach this class with her. And I've done 5 semesters now at Otis College. It's right next to LAX Airport here. Mm-hmm. Former IBM building, actually. The building itself is designed to look like the old punch cards that you'd use in a computer. It's striking architecture. And it's a full-blown, it's a ufology class. I mean, I'll have my students actually find a UFO case. I teach them how to investigate a UFO case, and that's one of their, you know, main projects of the semester, is doing the interview, gathering evidence, and presenting it in front of the class. Mm-hmm. And it is it's an accredited course.
Yeah.
Thankfully.
Yeah, I suggested to Henry Ford College that I do a course on UFOs and submitted the paperwork and never heard from them. So, but that was a few years back, and that was before Pentagon admitted that they're real. So it may be different.
Try submitting it again, because you know, the climate has changed and attitudes have changed about this phenomenon in the past, since 2017, and when the Tic Tac incident was on the front page of the New York Times.
Right.
I would say that's when disclosure actually happened. It's just been an ongoing slow drip disclosure.
Yeah, slow drip is right. That's right. I've always said that disclosure will come when ET decides it'll come.
Yeah, you're correct. Okay. I think that too. I think there's constraints put on us even by the entities themselves. I don't know that we're ready for prime time as a species yet. They want Star Trek, and we keep. I think that there would be a risk of us going out there and doing Star Wars.
Right.
I don't think they want that.
I'm afraid of that, yeah. And so I think they're afraid of that as well. ET's afraid.
No, they don't. I don't think they want to unleash us on the universe yet. I don't know that we're ready. I think we're getting there, and I think that, you know, those are one of the 3 things people are told when they have an experience. Nuclear weapons are evil. Don't try using them. Mm-hmm. You won't survive that. Nuclear engineers and military guys are told this all the time. Mm-hmm. Number 2, stop trashing your world. It's not replaceable. It's not a resource to plunder. And number 3, better yourselves. Live on a higher frequency, mm-hmm. and a higher vibration. And that confused me when I first heard it, but it technically means, you know, you need to become a little more spiritual, realize you're not the center of the universe.
Do you think if nuclear weapons started going out toward other countries, that ET would intervene?
There's different opinions on that. I personally think they probably would, if it was going to be a world, like a mutually assured destruction scenario. Mm-hmm. I don't think that they want to erase us and start all over again here.
Right.
Right. So I think that they might intervene, but I don't know that it would be a nice intervention. I think that we'd probably have cosmic babysitters forever if we tried it.
Yeah. Well, maybe we need that.
Maybe we do. I know. I like to think that humanity can be like Star Trek, but I guess we'll see. I so far so good. You know, they didn't stop us from bombing Japan in the Second World War.
No, but that was a surprise.
It was a surprise. I mean, and it was not a world destroying.
The aliens didn't know that the kids had found the matches yet.
Yeah.
And maybe boom, there we go. And they said, "Well, let's look into this."
No more.
So I do hope that they, at least, you know, if they're not going to just present themselves to our world and say, "Knock it off," I hope that they do in that case.
Yeah, me too. I kind of lean towards the, I think they probably would stop that. I don't think they want mutually assured destruction any more than we do. So
maybe they've already, shall I say, talked to the heads of state and told them,
yeah,
you know, this is what's going to happen. If you start destroying your world, we will step in.
Well, we know about, you know, UFOs and nukes. I mean, it's a thing. Robert Salas, commanding officer of Malmstrom Base, they turned off 10 of those ICBMs. He was there in the capsule when it happened. It didn't affect, it wasn't an EMP that they used, like an electromagnetic pulse. Mm-hmm. We can do that. No, the radio stayed on, the light stayed on, the air pumps kept going.